So he has some real faces to talk to. This is an internationally known award-winning journalist who has been to Iraq many times, spent, in fact, as long as 9 months there, getting the real stories that the rest of the media won't cover. He's an independent journalist and a book author. And he is especially known for being the voice of the Iraqi veterans. We have a table right over here for Iraq Veterans Against the War. All of you should go check that out. It's a very noble group. It's in a long tradition of resistance to imperialist war that American soldiers have been doing for generations. Dar Jamil is their voice in his book, which is called The Will to Resist. I'd advise all of you to take a look at it. There's a lot of testimony in there from the winter soldiers. So I think that's what he needs to, that's what you need to hear about him before he talks about conditions in Iraq now and whatever else he wants to talk about. Come on up, Dar. Where is he? Okay.
Thanks, everybody, for coming out today. Can everybody hear me all right? Okay. I decided to go just real quick. Why I decided to go to Iraq back early on in the occupation was probably for a lot of the same reasons that most of you are here today on this beautiful Sunday, and that's that you understand that something's fundamentally wrong with this country. And, of course, during the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq with George Bush sitting in the office of presidency, it was a lot more obvious and blatant. But like most of you, I was watching the corporate media, the selling of the war. We all remember the weapons of mass destruction that never existed. We all remember the ties to 9/11 that never existed. And we all certainly remember the lies of liberating the Iraqi people. Of course, that never existed either. And now, of course, it's so clear that we all see what this war was about and what this ongoing occupation is about. And now what is so clear about Afghanistan as well, which is basically the same thing. This is not about finding Osama bin Laden. This is about protecting and taking other countries' natural resources and pipelines for those resources. And I decided to go to Iraq to expose this and really give voice to the Iraqi people that wasn't being shared in most of the corporate media. And after all that time, I ended up writing a book about it that came out about 2 years ago from right now. And when I started going around on tour for that book, I started meeting folks like some of these folks who are here today, Iraq Veterans Against the War, veterans from Iraq, veterans from Afghanistan. And these folks started coming up and talking to me, and as always happens, as just did again right before I came up here, is I'd meet a veteran. Hi, how are you? Where were you in Iraq? When were you there? And how was it? And, you know, those of us who have been over in war zones, there is this bond that we understand what's happening over there. We understand what it's about. We understand what war and occupation does to human beings. And there's just this instant knowing. And I started talking back 2 years ago from right now. The first guy I met, it was literally 1 week into my book tour. He was Corporal Phil Aliff, a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And he was in Iraq. And I asked him, well, how was it for you over there? How was morale? And he said, well, morale was low. It was not good. We were basically driving around on patrols waiting to get blown up. We called it the IED lottery, the improvised explosive device lottery, basically waiting for a roadside bomb to go off. And we understood that this wasn't about our security. It wasn't about bringing the Iraqi people in any security. It was just basically about being there, driving around, mostly for the media to show, yeah, we have this presence on the ground. And so he said, we decided to stop doing these patrols. So what we would do is we would go out to the end of our patrol route. We would find a nice big open field. We would park our Humvees, and we would pretend. and we would call into base every hour, and we would say, hey, we're still searching the field for weapons caches. We'll talk to you in another hour. And he said that we called these search and avoid missions. And then I, about a week ago, well first of all, then I asked Colonel Aliff, well, how often were you doing this? And he said, oh, about every other day. Everyone was doing it. And I was shocked. I'd never heard that before. And then about a week later, I met another soldier, also active duty, different time of the occupation, different place where he was based in Iraq. Same story. We were doing search and avoid missions, little bit of variation on them. And then a little further into the tour, I met another member of IVAW, a guy named Seth Manziel, who now is outside Fort Lewis in Washington State. And he shared another interesting story of these this type of GI resistance that was happening in Iraq. And that by then it started to dawn on me, this is overt GI resistance that we're talking about here. These are soldiers who are refusing to participate in this ongoing illegal occupation. And Seth had found a very creative way to do search and avoid missions without even actually driving around in the vehicles. He managed to find a way to get into the computer in the Humvees and manipulate around the little dot on the GPS that showed their location back at headquarters and basically just move their dot around as though it was on a patrol. He said you just had to be careful not to move the dot too fast. So really new and interesting and creative ways to do resistance. And I started to dig deeper and deeper, and the deeper I dug, the more different types of resistance I found. And for a little context, our country has a long, rich tradition of GI resistance. All we have to do is look back to Vietnam. We had a GI resistance movement at that time that was absolutely massive and without a doubt helped bring an end to that war. And this happened because enough people got behind this GI resistance movement and supported them and came up and said, what do you need? What do we need to do to help you do more GI resistance? Because then, as many people now understand, and people like the members of Iraq Veterans Against the War, for starters, understand, is that unless there's real GI resistance and real civilian population support for GI resistance, any real talk about ending both of these illegal occupations is just going to be talk. But in Vietnam, we saw that talk translated into action, and we saw what could happen with a very broad, strong, vibrant, powerful civilian anti-war movement that then threw its weight behind a GI resistance movement, enough so that by the end of Vietnam, just about half the soldiers on the ground would not follow orders. So when you have a military and you're a government and you're trying to wage war, and half that military will not follow your orders, it makes it kind of hard for you to wage war. And so that, coupled with a very fierce Vietnamese resistance, helped bring an end to the war in Vietnam. Another example from Vietnam that a lot of people have never heard about is that towards the end of Vietnam, during the height of the massive air bombing campaign against that country, two of the United States' 14 aircraft carrier groups were completely taken offline by sabotage from sailors within those boats themselves. So this country does have a very rich history of GI resistance and a tradition that actually has ended one of the biggest wars of the last century. And it certainly can happen again. And this is not pie-in-the-sky stuff. So when we bring it into modern times and talk about GI resistance today, we know that according to Pentagon figures, and it's always safe to assume that figures like these coming directly from the Pentagon itself are on the low end. But according to the Pentagon, we've had well over 55,000 troops so far have gone AWOL since September 11, 2001. In the Army alone, from 2006 to 2007, we've seen a 42% increase of the number of troops going absent without leave. We're looking at an average of about 10,000 troops every year now that are going absent without leave because they see, for various reasons, anything from I just don't want to go overseas and be in combat to really high moral and ethical reasons, We have many soldiers now that are starting to stand up, even against Afghanistan, soldiers that have a deep understanding of international law and the U.S. Constitution, and understand that if they, as soldiers, agree to be deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan, that's going to be a direct violation of international law. It's going to be therefore a direct violation of the U.S. Constitution and cause them to completely violate the oath they swore as a soldier to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And if these soldiers who put everything on the line to do this, knowing they're going to be court-martialed, knowing they're going to go to jail, knowing they're going to risk losing their benefits, knowing they're probably going to get a dishonorable discharge and catch a lot of hell from their peers, are still willing to stand up and do it, then I think the question we all have to ask ourselves is, what are we willing to do to support these people? Because they're doing it right now. They're doing it every day right here in the U.S. to one degree or another. And people ask me all the time when I give talks now, especially about GI resistance, what can I do? What should we do? What can we do to help these people? Well, this is very easy right now today, because when I finish talking, you can go right over here to Iraq Veterans Against the War's table, and there's a couple of these guys here. They're in the audience right now, and go up, just literally go up and ask these guys, what can I do to help you guys? Because there's plenty of things you can do to support Iraq Veterans Against the War, whether it's making a donation to them or getting with these guys and asking them directly and finding out exactly, okay, here's what I can do. Maybe I can find some vets in my area that I can help support. Maybe there's someone here right now tonight that's today that has orders to deploy, and maybe they're having second thoughts about it, and they're going to need some support. They're going to need a lawyer. They're going to need some civilian support, certainly plenty of moral support. So there's a lot of things that can be done. And what I really want to impress upon you is that there is GI resistance happening, and it is growing as we speak. There's a group out in Oakland called Courage to Resist, and they're an advocacy group for soldiers who are refusing to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan. And they recently told me that in the last 3 months they've seen a 200% increase in the number of soldiers who are calling them who are deciding to refuse orders to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan. And what we need to understand, again, these are not people who are being unpatriotic. These are not people who are just saying, hey, I want to shirk my duty because I'm lazy. But these are people that realize that in order to follow international law and the U.S. Constitution and the oath they swore as soldiers to support and defend the Constitution, they are morally and lawfully obliged to publicly refuse orders to deploy to either of these illegal and immoral occupations. And it's up to us at this point to figure out, now how am I going to support that person? And how am I going to support more people in doing this? Because at the end of the day, if we start doing it here today and find one of these people to support and start carrying that forward and find more people to support tomorrow, that's how a resistance movement is built. We don't just talk about world peace and then get all disgruntled because Obama's not leading us to world peace, or some mythic figure arises from the mist and leads the anti-war movement towards helping create world peace. It starts by each one of us finding, what is it I can do, and going and taking that action right now to start trying to help. In my opinion, I think the most effective thing we can do in this moment is just start finding these soldiers and helping them to resist, because then over time that will add up. And then that will start to form a movement, and then more soldiers in the military see these others standing up. And we have very recent examples. We have one soldier named Victor Augusto. He was a specialist. He served in Iraq. He was there for 13 months. He came back. He was stop-lost, which means that the government decides we're not going to honor our end of the contract, and even though you're about to be discharged, we're going to send you to Afghanistan instead, because that's where they're getting these extra troops to send to Afghanistan. And he said, you know what? That's not going to happen. I'm not going to go. So he got a lawyer. He stood up. He was very public. And he articulated very clearly, I'm not going to be a party to war crimes. I'm not going to violate international law. I'm not going to violate the oath I swore as a soldier to support and defend the Constitution. And he stood up and he refused to go. Victor then was court-martialed. He was sentenced to 30 days in county jail. He
He got out about 3 weeks ago. I talked to him the day he got out, and I said, Victor, how was it? And he said, well, I slept at night. I could sleep with myself at night because I know I did the right thing. And then I asked him a little bit more, well, how was actually your jail time? And he said, actually, it was pretty relaxing. And this is the kind of guy that Victor is and so many of these other resistors are, is that they know without a doubt that they're doing the right thing. They know they're going to have to pay for it with sacrificing either a month or a year or sometimes more of their life sitting in jail because they've done the right thing. But again, they get out, they're free men. And then what Victor's doing is he's now getting ready to go out to Fort Lewis in Washington State because there's another Afghanistan war resistor who also just got court-martialed for publicly refusing orders to go to Afghanistan. And he's in the brig at Fort Lewis. And Victor's going to go out there and start working on this guy's campaign to draw attention to the illegality of what's being done to him, that he's following his conscience, he's following international law, and that's what he's choosing to do with his life today. And again, if soldiers with so much to lose, losing their jobs, losing money, losing benefits, losing the esteem of their peers, are willing to stand up and put all that on the line simply because it's the right thing to do, again, what are we willing to do to support these guys? Because they're here. There's some of them here today. I really encourage you to go back in a few minutes to the IVAW table and talk to these folks and ask them directly what you can do to help support them, not wage these illegal wars. Because let us remember, this country is involved in two ongoing occupations, and there's a lot of kids here today. And if we as civilians, as people from the United States, don't start doing what we can do right now to end these occupations, they're still going to be going on when these kids grow up to be 17, 18 years old, the age that military recruiters like to find them and try to convince them that going to war is a good idea. So it's up to us right now to get really busy, to start doing everything we can in our power to end both these wars. And I'm here to tell you that it is a very heartful, fun, invigorating thing to work directly with people, specifically people in the military, who are willing to put it all on the line to end these wars, take risks, and then even start to achieve some victories of people that are standing up, being discharged, and then becoming very powerful figures in the media and powerful figures in a young, budding, and growing GI resistance movement. It's a very exciting thing to be a part of, and so I encourage all of you to join us in that today. And you can start right now by going and talking with these veterans over at the IVAW table. So thanks, everyone, very much for coming out today.
Thank you, Dar Jamal. So, folks, if you haven't had enough yet, this is not over with Dar Jamal. There's going to be an intermission for the regular program, and Dar is going to continue with a question and answer session slash book signing slash discussion on this neat little stage to the side here. There's books and everything in a tent. Don't be scared by the lack of chairs. As I can see, everyone's sitting down right now on the grass. And just real quickly, if you have to head out right now, there is a regional demonstration being organized October 17th in Boston. There is transportation being organized for Connecticut. We have a meeting coming up October 4th in Middletown, and you can see people at the Connecticut United for Peace table or actually several other tables here, including American Friends Service Committee. So with that, hope to see everyone on the side stage starting right about now. Yeah, sure. And those of you who have lawn chairs, please bring them with you to the side stage.
Thank you, Dan. All right, everybody, come on over for the Q&A. This is the intermission. And if you're not doing the Q&A, make sure you circulate among the tables. Our excellent groups here to give you lots of information. And, of course, away across there, way out in the distance, we have the coffee house. Kookaburra couldn't be here today. I'm so sorry. I know everybody was lined up. But Sally Jo Borden, Brian Walsh, and Hannah's Field will be there at least. And don't forget, Emily Chassie has a book. You could go online, but she's right over here. And maybe, if you're lucky, she will sign it for you. See you in about 45.